Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So I thought I'd start off today's show with six short scientific curiosities, and then a few emails from listeners, just some interesting stuff that came across the bow over the last few weeks. And we're going to start off, as I said, with some scientific curiosities, mostly scientific. Let's start out with a man named Tim Freed. He's a former construction worker and a self-taught snake expert. And about 18 years ago, he began deliberately exposing himself to snake venom to see if he could become immune. So over 18 years, he self-administered more than 850 doses, about 200 from bites and the rest from injections. I will add that if you're trying to build up immunity, doing it with a syringe with a measured dose is a much better idea because, of course, you never know what dose you're getting when you let a snake bite you. The first time he allowed himself to be bitten, it was by an Egyptian cobra, then a monocled cobra an hour later when nothing happened. Well, he spent 4 days in a coma. And he kept at it and began posting about his experiments on social media. Well, here's where the story gets really interesting for you and me. Around 2017, Jacob Glanville, a immunologist, approached him. And Glanville and his team have developed an anti-venom from Freed's antibodies, which now that we can clone things and grow things and then distribute them, well, the sky's the limit. So they found the guy whose immune system had built the antibodies, and they've been trying it in mice, and what they found was that it fully or partially neutralizes the venom of 19 of the world's deadliest snakes, and that includes the dreaded black mamba, the king cobra, and the taipan. If human trials are successful, this could save lives. Tens of thousands of people die from snake bites every year. As Freed told the Washington Post, knowing what I'm doing can someday change medical history is wonderful. It is wonderful. This not so medical, but definitely a curiosity. Cuttlefish have sign language. Now, cuttlefish are related to octopi. You've seen them if you've gone to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. They have 8 sucker-lined arms and 2 tentacles, and they've been seen waving their arms around to intimidate predators or signal that they'd like to get it on. But now scientists believe that they also express more complex concepts. So this was this comes from the researchers at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, and they found that 2 species, the common cuttlefish and the dwarf, use 4 specific arm-waving signs that the team named, very creatively, up, side, roll, and crown. Up is when one pair of arms is extended upward and the others are tucked in. Side has the arms all brought to one side. Put all your tentacles on your right hip. Roll sees the arms folded under the head, and crown looks like when the person puts the fingers of 2 hands together to form a pyramid. The cuttlefish were shown videos of their comrades performing these movements, and they would sign back, but not necessarily with the same sign, which suggests they weren't simply mimicking. Interestingly, also responded with signs when the researchers recreated the vibrations that the sign made in water. So in other words, when you wave those things around, you create a ripple, and the ripple will have a different shape. And when they just recreated that shape with speakers, they got the same kind of responses from the cuttlefish. So now they're speculating that a cuttlefish may be comparable to octopus in terms of their intelligence. Of course, that is a speculation on minimal data, but I'm really glad that I don't eat cuttlefish because I already had to take polpo and calamari off of my menu, and I do like me my seafood. Speaking of food, it's long been thought that Neanderthals were hyper-carnivores, meat, more meat. The paleo diet kind of based on this concept of the caveman eating so much meat. And this was based on data that came from Neanderthal bones, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And what they found in the bones were elevated nitrogen levels, levels typically seen in apex predators like lions. So it was assumed that the hominids got most of their calories from fresh kill, like lions. But there was a problem there, because the dental evidence didn't back up the bone evidence. The dental evidence showed that Neanderthals also ate a lot of plants, and the way that they had ground down their molars meant lots of plants. And in any event, humans, at least Homo sapiens, can't safely metabolize that much protein. Well, researchers at Purdue University in Indiana have come up with an alternative hypothesis, which, while a little bit creepy, is, as I said, science curiosities. They've discovered that it may be that one of the Neanderthals' major diets was maggots in rotting meat. Yes, maggots contain up to 43% more nitrogen than animal flesh, and they believe that the Neanderthals' high nitrogen readings were due to maggots on their meat. They probably stored their kills in caves, pits, or trees where it rotted and attracted flies. And then they just kind of, the maggots were along for the ride, but they at least explain the contradiction between the teeth. Because, you know, a maggot's probably a little bit like a ripe strawberry or, you know, just not all that crunchy. And they're probably quite nutritious. It's, again, gross and creepy, but yep, science marches on. Another curiosity, you know that CPR that they taught you? Well, time to change the rules. It was always taught to me as ABC. First, you check the airway, then breathing, and then circulation. But doctors say, forget about the A and B, go straight to the C. This is new information based on, I'll tell you what it's based on, but basically the recommendation now is forget about looking for the tongue or trying to advance the jaw. Forget about rescue breathing. Just start pumping on that chest. And you want to hit it about 100 times per minute, so pretty fast, 100 to 120 times a minute, and you have to penetrate to a depth of about an inch and a half. So it's good to have a buddy around because you get tired pretty quickly doing that. And researchers had an interesting data set that they looked at. They looked at 45 athletes who collapsed. This is a sports footage. So, you know, somebody's filming the sports event and the athlete collapses and he has had a cardiac arrest. In 30 confirmed cardiac arrests, 27 athletes received inappropriate responses, such as efforts to clear the throat before CPR began. 18 of those 27 died or left in the coma, while the three who received immediate chest compressions, forget the airway stuff, actually survived and regained consciousness. Now, humans can hold their breath for about 5 minutes if they're trained up, and I certainly wouldn't be able to do that. I'd barely manage 45 seconds in the pool, but the point is, my brain cells don't start dying until 4 to 5 minutes. So if you can get that blood moving fast, even though you're not resupplying the oxygen, as the tissues become oxygen deficient, they become more acidic, and the increased acidity causes the hemoglobin to release more oxygen that it's holding on to and wouldn't otherwise release. So there's a built-in adaptive mechanism there. Pretty interesting, huh? It just keeps changing as more research emerges. Now, this was not a placebo-controlled trial. It's new information, but it's pretty compelling, and I think it would be reasonable to just start the chest compressions and have someone call 911. And if you're in a public place, try to find that bright red defibrillator, because out of hospital cardiac arrests, if they are defibrillated within 5 minutes, have an excellent chance of walking out of the hospital, better than 50-50. If they aren't defibrillated within 5 minutes, it drops down to 10%. So let's get that thing going. And of course, at sporting events, they've got your handy dandy portable defibrillator right there, ready to go. I wanted to give you a little bit of a statistic, and this is based on looking at MRIs and CT scans of individuals who are over 60. So this study was done in normal, pain-free volunteers, people just off the street. I like to say, you know, stand there with a clipboard as people go into the mall and say, "Hey, are you over 60? Yes. Do you have back pain? No. Okay. Would you like a free scan?" Anyway, what the MRIs showed was in these pain-free individuals, 9 out of 10 will have disc degeneration. 9 out of 10 will have disc signal loss or desiccation. 8 in 10 will have disc height loss. 8 in 10 will have a disc bulge. 4 in 10 will have a disc protrusion. 4 in 10 will have an annular fissure. 4 in 10 will have facet degeneration. And 3 in 10 will have spondylolisthesis. Now, here's the thing, folks. Think about it this way. Flip it. Who gets MRIs of the spine? People who go to the doctor with a complaint of back pain. So 9 out of 10 of them will have disc degeneration. Maybe 10 of the out of 10 of them will have disc degeneration. But the point is, if the asymptomatic older group already has this much in the way of abnormality, there's really no rational way, in most cases, from the scan alone, that a physician can, in good conscience, look the patient in the eye and say, "Okay, your back pain is due to this disc right here." Now, there will be some situations where that is true, but a lot of time, it's not a photo of your pain. It's a photo of your back, and you're not seeing is all the tendons and the ligaments and the muscles, and they can cause plenty of trouble all by their lonesome, trouble that will not be helped by surgery. It's many years now that I've been doing acupuncture, specializing in back pain, neck pain, phantom limb pain, neuropathic pain, you know, as my emphasis, although I will treat people for other things, because I see most of the people I see have already had the surgery for the MRI, and it didn't work because we were barking up the wrong tree. We fooled ourselves with our very sophisticated scans. So I just want you to realize how likely it is, if you're over 60 and listening to this program, that you have findings that would lead somebody to tell you that you need back pain, that you need surgery for that back pain you just developed. So proceed with caution is all I want to say. All right, our last curiosity before we get to some emails is, again, clever communicating cockatoos. Australia's sulfur-crested cockatoos made headlines a few years ago when they figured out how to open garbage cans to find food. Well, now the clever little guys have shown that they've learned how to drink from human drinking fountains. This is a report from National Geographic. Barbara Klump, a behavioral ecologist at Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior in Germany, noticed the behavior while she was visiting a park in Sydney for a different study. She spotted a group of birds waiting in line on a chain link fence for a chance to hop onto the fountain, grip the spout with one foot, and use the other foot to twist the handle to release the water. Klump planned her own study of the cockatoos, and after observing 24 tagged birds for over a month, she found that about 70 attempted to work the fountain, and about 40 succeeded. The other birds waited in line on the fence and proceeded in a regular fashion when the first bird had done with the fountain. Other sources of fresh water were available more easily. So Dr. Klump reached the conclusion that the birds were doing it for fun. Those birds, well, they really surprised me. I have to tell you one more story, and then we'll take a break. But this was about a little dog, a papillon with very fluffy ears that look like butterfly, hence the name, named Paris, who belonged to a friend of mine many years ago. Paris lived in a, 20th or 25th floor apartment in San Francisco. And Paris didn't get outside much except on a leash. But when she came to visit with her owner to my house, I have a dog door. And Paris observed my dog going out of the door and coming back in several times. And then I just happened to be watching when she nerved herself up to go out, to follow my dog out the dog door. You know, flap, 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 flap. About a minute later, Paris burst through the door, found herself in the kitchen, looked around, bounced back out through the flap, and spent the next 5 or 10 minutes just going in. I can go in, out. I can be out, and just enjoying the hell out of her newfound superpower. Somehow she no longer needed to stand in the elevator with the leash. Alas, it was only temporary, but you just, it's such fun to watch animal behavior, and I find that it lifts my heart. So it may sound silly, but if you are really down in the dumps, silly dog videos, baby goats, rabbit mishaps, it just, you can't help but laugh, and the laughter lifts your heart. So if you're in a place where you're really having trouble at the moment and you just need to get out of that dark space, yeah, try those funny animal videos. I think they're popular. I think they're popular because they are highly therapeutic. All right, we're going to go to our first email. And this one comes from Liz in Durham, North Carolina. Dear Dr. Dawn, a friend has asked me whether Issiac tea can help with cancer prevention. I would love to hear what you have to say. Well, let's talk a bit about Issiac. It's a combination of some good antioxidants. It's been around for, at least since the 70s. As having been invented, I believe, by an Irish woman, or it may have been by a, actually, I'm not sure what her nationality was now that I think of it. But it contains a blend of at least four herbs. The basic herb mixture is burdock root, Indian rhubarb, sheep sorrel, and the inner bark of slippery elm. And these are all herbs that have been used for various ailments in traditional herbalism. And the idea, the prompt or the ask is that this is somehow going to prevent cancer. And it's developed quite a lot of buzz in breast cancer, particularly as helping prevent the recurrence of breast cancers. It's very popular herbal remedy. However, the data is really thin and not persuasive. There are studies that show a positive effect of Issiac in cell culture of breast cancer cells, but that is a long way from being able to get that kind of concentration in the human body. It may be, for example, if you put enough salt in the dish with the cancer cells, you will kill the cancer cells, but you couldn't get that much salt in your body without killing all your cells. So the other studies have looked, so no studies that have looked at secondary prevention have shown a decrease in recurrence from users versus non-users. But I want to emphasize that that there are no really good high-quality scientific studies here, because there's no, well, it's very simple. Economically, those are expensive. no government has, out of the goodness of its heart, decided to do a big study. Big studies are hard and expensive to do. With respect to one study that was done in and studied in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine that I found in 2006, they were looking at health-related quality of life. And they had a functional assessment of cancer therapy, breast cancer version between women who were new ESSIAC users since their breast cancer diagnosis and those who'd never used it. And they looked at endpoints like depression, fatigue, adverse events, complications, and basically could not find any increased benefit whatsoever. In fact, there was a slight trend towards a negative effect, but they thought that might be because the ESSIAC was more commonly used by younger women who had a presence on social media, and they tended to have more advanced stages of breast cancer. This was just, you know, taking all comers study, so it wasn't a great study, and they didn't find anything. It doesn't mean it doesn't work. A negative study just it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't prove that it doesn't work. It just doesn't support the idea that it does, and that's a really important point here. Do I think it would hurt anybody? No. Would it maybe have an anti-cancer effect? Well, we're looking at some good antioxidants here, and antioxidants are always beneficial. I think that one of the things that I always encourage women who have a history of breast cancer to do is take a look at the actionable things that might be in their DNA, not BRCA1 or BRCA2, but things like COMT, which is catechol-O-methyltransferase, commonly mutated, maybe 3-7% of the population might carry a mutation there. And there are dietary things that you can do to improve the functioning of that. And I just, particularly in women who have early breast cancer while they're still ovulating, always take a look at it. And I do not have any kind of science behind it. I have a clinical impression, which is considered low quality evidence, that if we had known that about that patient earlier, based on her family history of breast cancer, we might have put her on a nutritional program that could have helped her avoid the mutations that led to the cancer. And that is unproven and speculative, but it falls into my category of no harm. So why not? Okay, so this one came from Surfer Nick. Thank you, Surfer Nick. And he is, surprise, surprise, in Santa Cruz. So new hope for Alzheimer's. Lithium supplement reverses memory loss in mice. Now, the lithium story is really interesting. And I thank you for bringing it to my attention. I actually had this in my stack of things to do. And so I'm going to just go ahead and review this a little bit. So we're going to start with medical history, okay? So in the 19th and 20th century, lithium was touted as a mood-altering health tonic. People were going after nootropics, brain-enhancing things, all the way back then. They were using cocaine and Coca-Cola, and so they were also using lithium in early versions of 7-Up, and it was perking you up, making you feel brighter, having that bright-eyed effect. It reemerged in the 70s, and it just was, you know, shelved after a while, because scientists noted that among people with bipolar disorder, brain aging was slower in those who were being given lithium as a treatment. I want to emphasize the dose of lithium that was being given for bipolar disorder was greatly, like 10 times greater than the doses that were back there in the 7-Up. Meanwhile, other studies showed that, this is back in the 70s, that regions where the water supplies contained higher amounts of lithium, trace element, in the water, had lower dementia rates. But when they tried to test lithium on cognitive decline, it really didn't. It was mixed results. Some studies were positive, some studies were negative. Now, it's hard to evaluate Alzheimer's disease with any kind of functional testing. So here's the problem. Functional testing, like, you know, how good is your memory? Can you remember five objects for 5 minutes, etc., is so variable within a single individual from day to day. It depends on what time of day you tested them. How did they sleep last night? What's their mood? Are they hungry? Is there a distracting noise outside? All of us who have taken tests for high school or college know that there's a lot of factors that affect whether you do well or poorly on the test that have nothing to do with whether you study. So with that much variability, it's extremely hard to prove a benefit unless you have a huge number of people, which gets to a huge expense. But researchers have been chipping away at the problem. So a group led by scientists, where are they located? Not seeing that. But this was published recently in Nature. The laboratory is led by a fellow named Yanker. And the research is super interesting. Here it is. Bruce Yanker, Harvard Medical School in Boston. And we've been barking. And I think the first thing to say is that we've been so fixated on amyloid plaques for Alzheimer's disease that we've really got two diseases. One is early onset Alzheimer's, people in their 40s, and they actually have a mutation in the beta amyloid gene. So they've got a defective protein to start with. And that defective protein breaks and twists very similar to the way the defective hemoglobin of sickle cell disease does. And this causes it to accumulate into plaques in the brain. We now think of it as the plaques lead to inflammation. In the second type of Alzheimer's, the one most of us are worried about, which occurs in the 70s and 80s, the plaques are probably the result of inflammation and essentially are a symptom, if you will, a physical change caused by an underlying inflammatory problem. We've also discovered that it doesn't correlate very well to the degree of disease, and there's some people who have lots of amyloid and very little sign of disease, so something else is going on here. The best thing, and it's not all that great, to emerge in Alzheimer's in the last couple of years is the tau test, but you have to have pretty high levels of tau protein in your blood for it to have much predictive value for you to develop Alzheimer's. I've had a couple of patients getting this test and coming in saying, you know, well, I've got a level of 24 and the upper limit of normal is 18. And when you look at a scatter graph of those levels, the 5-year risk for Alzheimer's for that individual is pretty low. If they've got a level of 50, on the other hand, there's a decent risk, probably 2 or 3 times chance, that they will develop Alzheimer's relative to the general population. So, yeah, I think the tau protein has its place, but we still aren't there with anything that's truly predictive. So what can we do in the meantime? Well, Yanker's lab first went looking for what is lithium naturally present in the brain, and they were able to establish that it was, and they showed that lithium levels were lower in parts of the human brain affected by Alzheimer's disease than in unaffected regions. They looked at people with mild cognitive impairment, which is a precursor to Alzheimer's in some cases, and they found that their brain lithium was tied up in the amyloid plaques. We now have the technology to see that. So the plaques act as kind of a trap for the lithium. And the amyloid that showed up in the mice, let's remember these are mutant mice who are mutated to imitate that early onset Alzheimer's, not the late onset Alzheimer's. So they have a defective amyloid protein. which is probably why we've been barking up the wrong tree for 30 years and blowing literally billions of dollars researching the wrong thing. But in those mice, the lithium also got sucked up into the amyloid plaque. So at least there's a proof of concept linking the amyloid with sucking up the lithium. And what they found was in the mice, at least, remember, these are mutant mice. We're not, and we're comparing mutant mice to non-mutant humans. So it's not great to extrapolate there. But those lithium deficient, the mice that had lithium deficient brains got worse. So it's hard to tell which is the chicken and which is the egg. Yanker and his team linked lithium loss to other markers of the disease, including those tau protein tangles. But again, we have a chicken and egg problem at the moment. So other clinical trials have looked at lithium carbonate. Why? Well, okay, lithium carbonate is the one that's used in bipolar disorder, but it's not the only form of lithium salt that humans can take. So there's also lithium taurate. And the reason this is important is because lithium orotate, is not sucked up by the amyloid plaques. It doesn't have an affinity. So if you give those mice that we talked about low doses of lithium orotate, it reversed disease-related brain damage and helped the animal's memory. The carbonate did not have the same benefits because it got sucked up into the plaque. So the authors are cautiously optimistic that maybe lithium could be a big factor in treatment of early cognitive impairment. They did find in the control group, because they did give it to humans at a small dose, 5 milligrams a day. This is mildly calming, and in my clinical experience, I've used this in people who aren't bipolar, but who are, let's say, bipolar light. There's a technical term for that in psychiatry called hypomanic, but I don't think it's a great phrase. But it just means they don't go fully bipolar. They don't get really grandiose. They don't spend all their money. They don't go and gamble at Las Vegas. They don't imagine that they're going to save the world, and they sleep. But they are perhaps not, they're like the lighter, simpler version of that. So they respond very well and kind of calm down with 5 milligrams a day of lithium. In their study with dementia, the people seem to do better on tests, but again, I don't necessarily believe that the tests are that great. But they also, the control group got better on the tests. So those with the highest lithium levels did better on certain specific memory tests. And so would we want to use lithium orotate in people with bipolar disorder? The jury is still out on that. Would you want to take 5 milligrams of this to see if you felt it had a cognitive effect on you? I don't see why you wouldn't, and it's over the counter, so maybe something to be thinking about. A complicated discussion of a very, very simple molecule. Look it up. This element is very low on the periodic table. All right, so let's move on to something that has blown the socks off of doctors, and this was published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. Colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer. It's the second leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. And standard management for stage 3 or high-risk stage 2 colon cancer includes surgery, followed by 3 to 6 months of 5-fluorouracil and oxaliplatin, or 5 months of capecitabine and oxaliplatin, or monotherapy fluoropyrimidine. And those are all very clear DNA toxins, and they are attacking the reproductive process of the cancer, but also, unfortunately, the reproductive process of all of your cells. Despite this treatment, recurrent disease is very common, 20 to 40% of patients. And of course, the surgery and the chemo cause side effects and reduce physical functioning. So we need ways to improve the survival and reduce the recurrence rate. So a research group composed of Australian and Canadian researchers, the United States couldn't participate because they weren't able to find enough people who met the criteria. I'm just about to tell you about the criteria. They did find, and over the long time, 2009 to 2024, they found almost 900 patients, and they randomized them. First, they matched them for disease severity and various other risk factors. Then they randomized them to an exercise group or a health education group. They followed them on an average of 8 years. And what they found was disease-free survival was significantly longer in the exercise group. The 5-year disease-free survival was 80% in the exercise group and 74% in the health education group. The hazard ratio of death for these two groups over that time frame was 0.63, a 40% decline in the risk of death. And so we have a very significant bigger difference. An overall survival odds ratio reduction of 30% is huge, right? That is, we would be singing from the hilltops if we found a chemo drug that did that, particularly a drug whose only side effect is muscle pain. And essentially, the exercise, how were they different? Well, the exercise group got a exercise guidebook specifically for colon cancer survivors. It was it was about 75% just walking and about 25% lifting. They also had a support. They had a trainer, essentially, a certified physical activity consultant for 3 years, and it was 17 evidence-based techniques for behavior change. In the first 6 months of the program, patients attended a total of 12 mandatory in-person behavioral support sessions scheduled every 2 weeks, combined with 12 mandatory supervised exercise sessions, plus 12 recommended supervised exercise sessions during alternate weeks. During the second 6 months, they had the 12 behavioral sessions and the every 2 weeks in person. And then during the last 2 years, another 24 monthly in-person or remote behavioral sessions. And if the patient wanted to come for a supervised exercise, they could do so. Well, so that was a very, very intense intervention, but not nearly the cost of some of these new chemotherapy drugs. It was amazing. So the equivalent, so how much exercise did they do? Well, they had to do 10 METs per week. And this was moderate intensive exercise. So, for example, an hour of brisk walking, and brisk would be, 3.5 miles per hour, something manageable like that, is 4 METs. So you'd have to do effectively 2.5 hours of brisk walking, lifting, carrying, shoveling, bicycling. It was a substantial commitment. That's why they couldn't find any people, they couldn't find enough people in the United States who were willing to do that. So they couldn't find the body weight matched controls in the United States. So the Australians and the Canadians had to carry the water here to show that exercise after colon cancer treatment is the single most effective preventative therapy that has been identified ever. So that is good news that you can use. Well, my morning routine consists of waking up, usually spontaneously, although every now and then the alarm beats me to it, doing a little stretching and going downstairs and brewing myself some coffee. Now, I love coffee, and I drink a lot of it. Humanity loves coffee. Humanity drinks about 2 billion cups of coffee every day, which kind of boggles the mind. It's been suggested and shown in many studies that moderate consumption of caffeine does not appear to be harmful, unlike the recent studies that show that even moderate consumption of alcohol has been associated with increased cancer rates. I was sad to see that. But some of the components of coffee, including cafestol, kawiol, caffeine, and chlorogenic acids, also reduce inflammation, and they also they're antioxidants, so they reduce cell damage by oxidation, which is what causes most cancers. Recent study reported in the Journal of Cellular Biochemistry showed that cafestol and kawiol, which are more prevalent in unfiltered coffee than paper-filtered coffee, arrested tumor growth by making it less likely that new blood vessels would form around tumor cells, and that chlorogenic acids inhibited the formation of carcinogens within the body. Now, these coffee researchers have definitely given us a good reason to think about it. Another study that came out of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, and I am going to butcher this name, Jin Kyung Oh, did the lead research showing that postmenopausal women who claimed to drink 3 or 4 cups of coffee per day were significantly less likely to develop breast cancer than women who said they drank up to 2 cups. Similar reports from Japan suggested that those who say they drink 3 or more cups every day had a reduced risk of developing breast cancer. I want to emphasize that with the exception of caffeine, the other compounds, the cafestrol, the chlorogenic acid, and the kawiol are all present in decaf coffee. So it's all caffeine itself is being used to treat people with mild cognitive deficit. And a report came out of Taipei in 2020 that patients with Parkinson's who consumed caffeine regularly had a slower progression than those who abstained, which again makes sense because oxidative stress and inflammation are what lead to the neuron loss. So there's challenges in doing coffee research. You've got, for example, coffee coming from many different terroirs all over the world. You're having them roasted in different ways, cold, and then made in different ways, everything from percolator to paper filters to cold brew. And really, no one's been able to show any harm. So let's say moderate consumption, as in 3 or 4 cups of coffee a day, is probably fine. Overindulgence? Well, more than 400 milligrams of caffeine, and just a small little cup of espresso has around 60 milligrams. That can lead to irritability, muscle tremors, insomnia. I think we've all gotten over-caffeinated. I remember an episode with my dog eating all the chocolate-covered coffee beans that was impressive. But those other ingredients that have the anti-cancer benefits have never been shown to be a problem. Here's a disappointing study on coffee. This was one done on 46,000 adults. It was published in the Journal of Nutrition. And the results showed that people who drank between 1 and 3 cups of coffee today were 15% less likely to die during the next decade than those who consumed none. Well, that's lovely. I like that one. But that being said, the benefit vanished if they stirred more than around a teaspoon of cream or more than half a teaspoon of sugar into their drink. So the blacker, the better, apparently, if you're looking for those longevity and anti-cancer benefits. Since we live where we live in California, and we were early on the let's say, early on the COVID train, and that was a disease that started in China. There's a whole lot of travel going back and forth between the Chinese mainland and Hong Kong and the West Coast. And I just want to tell you a little bit about chikungunya, because it's summer and we do have mosquitoes that can vector it. And it's a mosquito-borne illness. And there's an outbreak of more than 8,000 cases in the Foshan city, a city of about 10 million people, very high-tech center. And it's in Guangdong province. They've also been reported about 400 miles to the north in Hunan province and to the south in Hong Kong and Macau. So it is a mosquito-borne, mosquito-vectored disease. It's been around for a while. It was first identified in 1952. It's pretty contagious, and spread can occur through blood transfusion, and it is not screened for in blood. The screening is done as in, have you traveled outside of the United States in the past? I believe they do 3 months. And if the answer is yes, they don't want your blood, which is probably prudent. But here's the thing. We've got a couple of we got lots of people traveling. And there's nothing wrong with coming back from China with this thing incubating. Or for that matter, coming back from South America incubating dengue. And as physicians, this morning we were treated to the second of several talks about summer viral fevers, and this one was focusing on dengue, but they touched on the chikungunya to help us understand, you know, what should you be watching for. And the main reason I'm going on and on about this is because in a busy emergency room, they may not always take your travel history. So what you need to know is, if you have traveled outside of the United States to any tropical area and you develop fever and bad body aches or bad joint pain, there's other symptoms. But in chikungunya, at least, the major big symptom is really severe bone pain, like deep bone pain, which is not something that's typical of other viral illnesses. We've all had the influenza and had the body aches, I think. But if you get bone pain, and you definitely want to say that, Zika and dengue are also showing up in the United States, mostly in travelers. But the problem is, as mosquitoes become a bigger and bigger problem, here's your neighbor travels, their next door neighbor, the person in the office next to you, the guy having a picnic at the park, and they get bitten by the mosquito, and the mosquito comes over and bites you. Well, that virus has been along for the ride, and so you don't have to have a travel history. And as we get more warming and we have more stagnant water in various places, these things are climbing northward and southward, really. So places like Argentina, which are pretty far south and temperate, are starting to see more of more dengue, for sure. And this is going to keep happening. So what can you do? Well, you can give if you show up in the hospital or to your doctor's office with a fever and you have a travel history, please volunteer that information. Don't wait to be asked. It changes the differential diagnosis for the doctor. It helps them not make a mistake and just assume that this is a summer flu. It helps them think about other things. So give that travel history. That's what you can do. And what your doctor can do is think about asking for a travel history. And if they get one, definitely think about these tropical mosquito-borne diseases, because this is just something we're going to have to start thinking about now. We really don't have much of an alternative. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.